One of the really important things is, I think, in especially in starting the kindy care journey, is there are going to be ups and downs. Sometimes it's important to sit with those feelings that aren't so good, and we have to cope, we have to grieve the loss of the life that we once had, and kind of reconciling this new sort of existence. And one of the biggest things that I had to come to terms with was that getting a transplant wasn't a cure per se. It was sort of a transition into a better way of life. And so the biggest thing for me was having a peer group who was going through it. So connecting with others who are going through it, it works magic. I don't know, I can't explain it. I'm like lit up, I'm inspired, I'm like all of a sudden everything feels a little bit more okay.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories of transplant recipients and living donors, along with the insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, I was joined by Crystal Hardy, a kidney patient, transplant recipient, researcher, and advocate whose strength and resilience are woven through every part of her work. Crystal brings a rare and powerful perspective to kidney care, drawing directly from her own journey through dialysis and transplant, a journey she often describes as her first and most important case study. Through lived experience, Crystal has transformed challenge into insight and insight into action. Her work centers on being seen, being heard, and redesigning systems of care so they meet people where they are, culturally, geographically, and emotionally. Please enjoy. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. I am thrilled to have Crystal here with me. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here talking to you today.
Amazing. We got to meet for the first time in person just recently when we were in Thunder Bay, and you talked about your personal journey with dialysis and transplant and your diagnosis, and I really connected to a lot of what you talked about. And, as such a, going through this as a young person and, going through this journey, feeling like you're thrown into it with not a lot of knowledge. I'm wondering, being a patient yourself, and then now also a researcher, you're seeing that kidney care from both sides of the field, which not a lot of people are able to do. I'm wondering if there is a moment that you'd be willing to talk about, whether it was your diagnosis, your first time on dialysis, your transplant, or what your journey is like right now, that has shifted how you saw your own life or how you saw yourself in this life that you've been on this kidney journey now for a while.
I think, yeah. Thank you for that. I think so. It's hard to really extract one singular moment in that trajectory. It's a long, as you know, like a long journey with a lot of ups and a lot of downs. There's some difficult moments, and then there's some incredible, joyful moments in that journey too. So I think there were a lot of integral spots. So for me, I remember coming into dialysis the first time. And being young, being in dialysis was a big scary thing. But I saw people in there who were joyful and expressing kindness and carrying on with life and living these very fulsome existences. And I think that I held on to that hope because I was like, oh, this is, if this person can live this way and can give back to the community, I'm thinking in particular of Mona Hardy, who was, at the time volunteering at the renal unit in Thunder Bay, despite being a dialysis patient herself. And she would do that every day. She would go when she wasn't on dialysis and she would volunteer in the unit. She would uplift people. She was joking. She was smiling. And she did that for her entire life. And so I thought, wow, this person has a very important role in her life and I can continue to do that too. And so that gave me, it sort of sparked something in me where I was like, okay, life isn't over. Dialysis doesn't have to be the end of the line.
Right.
And I think that was important because up until that point, coming from Rocky Bay First Nation, Beachtalwitzagen. All I really knew about dialysis was what I had seen in my community, which was, or heard about in my community, which was a lot of people having to travel back and forth from the reserve to the Thunder Bay for dialysis treatments daily.
Yeah.
So that's a couple hours drive each day.
Wow.
And then, you know, having sort of an expedient deterioration in their wellness and really, really poor outcomes. And so I was able to sort of redefine what it meant to be on dialysis. You know, it didn't have to look like that for me. Because of those people that I saw in the unit, those people who were hopeful, joyful, still continuing to live and thrive with dialysis supporting their care and their wellness. And so I think that shifted that. And then I guess that goes on, like, really, there's a lot of, for me, I'm a person who I like to observe and kind of make sense of my own journey. I think that's probably a coping mechanism of mine. And so as I went through dialysis, and then onward to, receive my first transplant, I made note of a lot of little things that really stuck with me. So it was really my own best case study.
Amazing.
I like to say.
Yeah. Right.
And then I think that, yeah, that really transformed how I was able to look at myself in this role. And then in that way, I viewed my experience as something I could maybe give back to my people, to First Nations people experiencing kidney disease.
Amazing. And you know, using those personal experiences to then shape your research and your advocacy. Like, I like how you said you were your first case study, right? That's incredible. And, you know, being able to use it, I think I do that sometimes in my work too, right? When I talk to people who are on kidney wait lists and, you know, we talk about how to find a living donor or what supports are available. And I think having that initial talk with them saying, I know what hemodialysis is like. I know what peritoneal dialysis is like. I know what transplant is like. I know what it's like to feel like you have an itch inside of you that is the driving you insane, right? Today I talked to somebody who said, I can't focus on anything because I'm so itchy. And I remember that feeling. And, you know, people who haven't been through it, they can understand what an itch feels like and scratch it, but they don't understand
the high phosphate.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, having that knowledge of being in that chair, I've been in that not so easy chair, you know, that's incredible. And I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about it, but how else has your personal journey really shaped that research and advocacy work that you do for Indigenous kidney health?
I think it was a lot of observation and listening. Like I said, I started out my journey in Thunder Bay, so as the Thunder Bay Regional Health Sciences Center, and in their dialysis unit, and I was supported. It was, for me, it was sort of like I found it to be a really supportive environment, but I did observe a lot of in particular First Nations patients who weren't treated well, and so I think I started to take note of these things and make note of what was happening, what some of the gaps were. I started to notice, you know, it's kind of a breakdown in, although the care providers were doing their best, where maybe breakdowns were occurring even in my care. And I was able to sort of adapt and say, like, I can adjust to these gaps because I have the supports I need. And maybe the educational background to do that. But then I was wondering, you know, how do elders from the north, from remote rural First Nations, how do they adapt? You know, when they're told that, for example, their blood pressure medications aren't working. Cause you know, on dialysis, you often have to be on blood pressure medications to regulate. And so if, you know, if the physician is telling you, your care provider is telling you, I don't know what's working, like, you're going to have to figure this out. Which happened to me at one point, then I think, how does an elder who doesn't speak English, who doesn't understand pharmacology, how do they adapt to something like that? And so I think I just track these things over the trajectory of my care. And it wasn't a matter of denigrating my care providers either, because they're really caring people who were trying to support. But I think it was like understanding that there were gaps where the care was breaking down, and wanting to support both the patients, First Nations patients, meet patients where they're at, and also support the care providers and bring together a more culturally cohesive, culturally congruent system where we could adapt support services, reach patients where they're at in a meaningful way, so that a lot of people wouldn't have to have the struggles that maybe I observed or I experienced. Understanding, you know, there are different variables. Even the cadence of your speech can matter when you're talking to some First Nations patients. And so wanting to bring that into the education, the curriculum, the pedagogy, when we're talking about teaching about dialysis and foods. I was fortunate to co-author a paper with my supervisor on renal-friendly foods during my master's while I was on dialysis. And so that gave me a lot of insight into what was going on and some of the gaps that emerged there. And just looking at the essential need for nutrition literacy. And I was thinking to myself, and so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how these gaps could be addressed. It wasn't like a quick fix. There's not a quick fix, I don't think. It was just a lot of thought and consideration about how, you know, do we adapt the system to support First Nations so that we can improve outcomes, because it's a very multifaceted and layered system that needs support on both ends, both for the care providers and patients.
I have to say to you, one thing that you did in the session that we had in Thunder Bay was, for listeners, we had a patient who was there, and he was asking a lot of questions and standing up, and, you know, he asked questions after every session, which I loved. But the thing that really touched me was when you stood up and you said, "I see you." And that was so powerful. Like right now I'm even getting chills from it. Like being able to say that to somebody, and he felt it. Yeah. Everybody in the room felt it. Like being able to actually say that, "I see you," it's so powerful. And knowing that, like, you do, and then you took that and built this project around what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've recorded. Like there's such power in being able to say that to somebody else.
Absolutely. And I think I just remember, I know because I've gone through the system, maybe you can relate to this. It's easy to feel very small.
Yes.
In a system that big.
Right.
And to not know which way is up, to not know what's next, to not know who to look for support or help, and who do we ask? How do we ask for help? How do we express our fears? How do we express our concerns in a system that's really big, mm-hmm. When we're unfamiliar with these pieces? And so I think that is really important, is to acknowledge like that individual and to say, "Hey, like, I've been there. I've seen that. We've seen that. We've been there, and we're going to do something about it if we can. We're going to support you. We want to hear you." And I think that's really an important part of why we're bringing in First Nations patient partners into the project. Mm-hmm. We want those voices to kind of lead the project and have those experiences shape the work that we do. So,
so important. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that project for listeners who may not know. What is the Indigenous Kidney Health Project?
So I had the opportunity to do my doctoral dissertation at the Edgeware Transplant Center with Dr. Mucci, who is a transplant nephrologist. Mm-hmm.
Amazing man.
And he's very nice, amazing. Yeah. Yeah, he's such a kind-hearted, grounded human. And so I came into it wanting to look broadly at facilitators and barriers to First Nations renal care throughout the care continuum. There were a lot of gaps that emerged. You know, there's a lot of patients, for example, having to sell off everything, leave their home communities, and so experiencing that cultural disconnection from family, home, culture, community, language, having to move into a center like Thunder Bay, which is much bigger than a lot of First Nations. And so that's a culture shock on its own. And then from there, having to go onward to a larger center like Toronto, with very few, if any, supports often. And so looking at, you know, these things started to emerge in the internship, and it was like recognizing these patients weren't being supported sufficiently and adequately in that process. So we decided, because, and there were a lot of other supporters too at UHN, Dr. Mike Anderson was one of them, but was looking at this work was so underrepresented in the system. This is a major gap that just hasn't been addressed in healthcare. And so I was looking at how can we build the site more broadly and build it out beyond the parameters of the internship. So we did expand it to include my dissertation, which will more broadly look at, you know, using Indigenous story work, which will preserve, you know, the narrative essence of the individual's experiences. And pairing that with medical chart reviews so that we can have something sufficiently to say, these are where the gaps exist, these are the outcomes, and maybe start to look at how do we address these gaps? How do we address these gaps? Where can the supports be enhanced, supported, facilitated? And then we'll have this the quantitative evidence to back that up systemically. Mm-hmm. But then also, the more important part, I think, is always that qualitative component. You know, building out a team to support transplant patients who come from the north. We have to look at those pieces and really begin to understand that so we can do better and improve outcomes, because these things have definite significant impacts on the trajectory of health and outcome and care and access.
For sure. And I mean, this isn't the first time that I've heard that happening. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done episodes of podcasts and also just talked to patients in general who have had to do those things. And I mean, it's shocking to hear, you know, you're thinking about, this is going to change my life. I'm going to get a transplant, and, you know, I'm not going to have to do dialysis. I may be able to go back to community because I'm going to be healthier and I don't have to travel anymore to get to right. Thunder Bay. And then all of these, you know, barriers and blockages happen to make this so much harder for patients, and thinking about leaving everything behind and then being alone in a brand new city when you're going through that health journey, like it's
difficult.
Oh my,
it's
goodness.
Difficult even with supports, right?
Exactly.
It's a very difficult journey. And so, and I think about even coming from Thunder Bay. So my first transplant workup, I was living in Thunder Bay at the time. And it was a difficult process, even though I lived in the city.
Right.
And I had my familial supports and my friends and my community around me. And that was difficult. And it took a long time. I was on dialysis for 3 years while I waited for a transplant. And that's not that bad. Wow. But this time around, my transplant workup living in Toronto was done in a matter of months.
Wow.
And so, you know, there's a big difference. And so, you know, geography has significant impacts on, you know, direct impacts on transplant referral rates and transplant workup rates. And so we have to look at why that is.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to look at equitable care, you know, it's really important, you know, that I think, especially looking at how many First Nations live in rural and remote regions,
mm-hmm.
How are they being underserved because of this system level gap, and how can we do something about that? We know that's, yeah, it's a real issue.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about all of those things, and, you know, I'm shocked that, you know, these massive systems in these massive places, we don't have those things in place that can easily just say, okay, this is the gap that you're facing, this is how we fix this, or these are the supports we have available so that you don't feel alone when you're going through this, or you don't feel like you have to sell off all of your belongings and move from your community. So I mean, you know, this research as a first step is incredible, and getting people involved in it and having more insight into knowing. And, you know, I with your research, you know, listening to your presentation and learning a little bit more, you highlight the fact that First Nations people are referred for transplant up to 3 times less often than non-Indigenous patients. With your research, what are some of the things that have come up about this? Like, we've talked a lot about geography. Can you talk about some of those causes behind that gap?
Yeah. And so actually, there's a report by the Ontario Renal Network that indicates that for some regions, First Nations might actually be receiving transplant referrals even 7 times less than the non-Indigenous population. And so it's, the gap is excessive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what my research will hopefully uncover. That's what we're hoping to understand, is why those gaps exist in referral rates. Policy oversight, is it individual biases? What's happening? But we do hope to uncover those answers, because that is a big gap. We don't know at this time why those rates are so low.
Wow. We've also talked a little bit about like a cultural mismatch that often exists between patients and providers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hear a lot about like cultural safety or cultural coherence, or, you know, all of these hot words that people use nowadays. But what do you think a safe patient provider relationship in kidney care would look like in actual practice?
Yeah, I think it's multi-layered. And so I think it's really the providers coming to the First Nations patients and Indigenous patients and saying, what is it that you need? And actually meaning it.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is meeting First Nations patients where they are. And sometimes that means, I think, in community. And so restructuring systems so that, and I know a lot of actually nephrologists and care providers are at present going into community and doing this. So that's really great to hear. You know, ensuring that they can have supports, elders, family members in the room and not feel like an inconvenience. It's ensuring, you know, like I talked a little bit about cadence and rhythm of speech. These are important, but very subtle and very nuanced things that can matter. I think understanding these nuances is really important. And also, I think it's important for us as First Nations people to see ourselves in the care system, and that really improves care congruence, cultural congruence, and improves outcomes. So at this time, I don't know how many, I know there are quite a few First Nations physicians. I don't know how many First Nations nephrologists or Indigenous nephrologists there are. But I think that's an important stepping stone in this, in improving outcomes, is being able to see ourselves in the care providing space. And I think that encourages patients to be able to speak openly and say, these are the questions I have. I'm not feeling safe because of this. This is what my needs are. And be able to direct their care more openly and in a safe way, I think starts from there primarily.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about like prioritizing individuals over groups, right? We've talked about, you know, how sometimes people can go into thinking, you know, this is a group that I'm dealing with. We just had our African Caribbean and Black Oregon Health Summit on the weekend, which was so much fun. And one of the speakers was saying, you know, instead of saying, okay, this patient is part of this group, therefore this is the care that they're going to get, it's individual care. Like you said, like, what does this patient need? What are they going through? And one of the things that came up in our conversations was specifically about diet too, right? Like, plantains are a really big piece of the ACB community diet. And they said, you know, that's pretty much a no-go when we're on dialysis, yes. Right? It's really high in potassium.
Yeah.
So rather than saying, you know, you cannot eat this, all of these things in your diet are a complete wash and they're all gone and we're going to start from scratch. It's, you know, how do we adapt our diets so that we still are eating things that feel like comfort and that feel like home, but we're doing it in a safer way. You know, some people might need a low phosphorus diet, other people don't. And some people might really like this one food that is not good for them. So, you know, how do we work with each individual patient to make sure their care is comfortable?
I think we can tie that back to the cultural congruence and the cultural coherence with our care providers. So for example, I've talked to my current dialysis nephrologist and I said, hey, I like eating pasta and tomato sauce. And so I manage my potassium. And so I can check it every so often. He allows me to track my data points more frequently than other patients get their blood work checked. And so we do this so that I can moderate my potassium and I know my intake and I can kind of get a general idea of how much is safe for me to eat as an individual. This is so important, but it started with having a conversation and feeling safe enough to have a conversation with my physician.
Yeah.
I think that's really important because often patients don't have to just exclusively eliminate potassium and phosphate and sodium. It's a matter of managing it. And I think you get the wrong idea. And there's a lot of frustration that comes from that.
Right.
Because I talked to one patient a few weeks ago who said, you know, I'm told I can't have potassium. Now they're telling me my potassium's too low. I got to eat potassium. And then he said, I'm really frustrated. I don't know what they want from me. And I think if we started the conversation more honestly and openly and say, these levels are going to fluctuate. Your body's not able to manage them. So we're going to, and we can adjust your dialysis to like maybe moderate for some of this or adjust for some of this.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm wondering too, you know, in your work, you've said that it's guided by principles like two-eyed seeing and Indigenous story work. And how does this influence how you collect and share knowledge in your research? And for people who don't know what two-eyed seeing is, can you explain what that is too?
Yeah. So I'll explain it in the context of this research. So really it was, I think, like I said earlier, it's always important to hear the firsthand stories and experiences of the individuals going through this, going through the care continuum, having a kidney disease and understand their perspectives, because that's where we find out, you know, what needs to be supported, redressed. And so that's where Indigenous story work comes in, which would be one of the eyes. So two-eyed seeing really like takes an Indigenous lens, and blends it with biomedical Western lens. And by doing that, we're able to provide, I think, a more fulsome body of evidence that can support broader systemic change meaningfully, while preserving the essence of the experiential piece, which is really important. And it's like honoring that is really important. I think two-eyed seeing allows us to do that while also getting the sort of the quantitative aspects from the medical chart reviews. So what do you want to call them? Like the biomedical data points that would demonstrate what is going on with care, what's going on with transplant wait list times and referral workups. So we can get those important pieces of information and tie that back to the experiences. And using the two-eyed seeing framework allows us to do that in a good way and blend those systems. So one eye coming from the Indigenous perspective, one eye coming from the Western biomedical perspective.
Interesting. I spoke with a living donor one time, and they said they were going into surgery and they wanted to have their family members in the room before they went down, and they wanted to do a ceremony with their family.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was so early in the morning, and there was a specific number of people that were only allowed in the room. And, they were like, how are we going to manage this? Because I can't go into this surgery without this kind of ceremony and blessing from my community. And so thankfully, you know, they had that conversation with their healthcare workers. And they said, yes, if this is something that you need to make this, you know, a positive experience for you and make you feel like when you're donating, that you're ready to release that organ, right? And that it's being, you know, given to that next person, and you're filling it with love and all of these things that you want to do. And so they had a smudging ceremony. They had their family around them. They prayed for them. They hugged, you know, they did all of the things that they wanted to do. And then when they took them down to surgery, like they said to me, they felt so complete and so comforted and relaxed. And, you know, they're going into this massive surgery and they're saying, because I just had that moment with my community, I felt ready and I felt willing to do this. And, you know, I think that was a really cool example of, you know, bringing those two pieces together. I loved hearing that too, that, you know, that can happen. And I think, again, you know, having those conversations, like you said, being open with your team and having a team who's being willing to talk about it too, right, is so important.
Oh, yeah. And I think UHN and Thunder Bay Regional are both really great. Like, I know they have facilities to support smudging. So they have like a ceremony room and like there's a space where you can go and do your smudging and sit and do prayer and stuff. So I think they're doing really great things already. Which is awesome as a support. It's nice to come into a big institution like that as a First Nations creation and say, oh, there's a space for me. Like, they're respecting and honoring me, and I feel seen. And that's part of it, is feeling seen, right? But I think that's a really great first step towards that cultural congruence piece we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. We talked a little bit about this, but, you know, one of the things that we hear a lot about is geography, those types of barriers, with people who have to travel long distance for the transplant or for the dialysis. Are there navigation or relocation supports for patients, and what kinds of those supports are most needed for people?
Yeah, so I think there are some.
Mm-hmm.
Through NIHB, there are travel supports and travel grants, but it does require, most often, as far as I'm aware, for the patient to pay up front.
Oh, okay.
And so that can be difficult. And so the reimbursement structure can be difficult for some patients to manage,
mm-hmm.
Which is a barrier for a lot of patients coming from the remote or rural communities. I know the Thunder Bay Regional has some really great Indigenous service supports for their patients too. Indigenous navigators. Toronto General also has a pretty big network for their Indigenous Services Center, and they have a lot of Indigenous navigators. But again, patients are still falling through the gaps. And so patients who are coming from the north, unless they're bringing their own supports with them, which is difficult because I know NIHB will cover, sometimes they'll cover one escort. And it's that, you know, that's a heavy burden to put on an individual, but it's not always possible for that person to leave work, family responsibilities, community responsibilities, and come to somewhere like Toronto for an extended duration of time. Like I mentioned earlier, that one individual that we're trying to support right now and figure out what to do to support, he's been here for months. And so he's been by himself because nobody can come and support him in Toronto, and his care is so extensive, and when he needs care and support for this long. And so there are things in place to support to some extent, but they're not sufficient. And so we're trying to figure out, how do we expand those services? What does that need to look like? Does that look like building out a care team here from, you know, fellows from the nephrology department here at Toronto General? Who do we look to do this, and how do we structure it so that the support is effective and meaningful? Those are questions that are still somewhat unanswered, but that we're trying to piece together through collaboratively with individuals who are going through it and say, like, what do you need? What are the resources you need? How can we support you in getting to appointments in Toronto and, you know, caring for yourself? The personal care piece is really important, to let you know when they're trying to recover from transplant and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So.
Yeah. Do you have any, you know, ideas of promising steps or partners that have been helpful in making kidney care more equitable and feeling more like home for Indigenous patients?
Oh, I think a lot of people are. From my experience at UHN, I'll start there just from the beginning of my journey through my internship. A lot of the surgeons, a lot of the transplant coordinators, the nephrologists, and other care allied healthcare providers are all really engaged and eager to support and enhance care for First Nations and Indigenous patients broadly. And there's a lot of really good work going on by a lot of people at UHN. And then I think also there's the Ontario Renal Network is doing a lot of really fantastic work, making great strides to support First Nations care. They've done a lot of research to identify gaps and build out supports where possible. And I think even in this, in developing my dissertation, UHN has partnered with it. We've got the Ontario Renal Network partnering with it, CanSol CKD, which is incredible. And then also the Association of Iroquois and Allied Indians is supporting it. Anishinaabeg Nation is supporting it. So you've got the First Nations PTOs that are in support of their own people and wanting to get care and services and access to the communities, to the individuals. And then, yeah, I think it's been really hopeful how eager everybody is to support and see this brought to life and see patients cared for in a good way.
Amazing. That was, going to be my next question about hope, right? I mean, that's kind of something that drives all of us patients is that hope behind things. And I'm wondering what gives you hope about the future for care for Indigenous patients, for First Nations patients who are going through this kidney journey, and whether it's on dialysis or transplant or pre-dialysis, what is it that gives you hope? For those patients going through this now.
I think I'm grateful for my own journey because it was so complicated and so complex. It gave me a lot of experience to be able to tie into, like I said, more research and my understanding. And I think now, this time around, for waiting for this transplant, I now have a better understanding of apheresis and, some of the more genetic-based complications that can arise with kidney transplantation and First Nations patients. And so bringing that to light, bringing food sovereignty to light this time around. It's really using my experiences gives me hope to improve care for others. And I think it's happening. I think a lot of people seeing, like I mentioned, all the individuals who are doing really great work, Dr. Mucci notably, all these people who are eager to support care and bring care to the communities and to the patients is really inspiring.
We talked about a lot of things today and a lot of your research, and one thing that comes through a lot of it, we did talk about hope, but also, having that connection that you have been through this and you're continuing to go through this. We talk often with people about how whether you're doing dialysis or whether you're transplanted, the kidney journey is a lifelong journey with different types of treatment. And I'm wondering, thinking about your journey up until now, if there's somebody listening who is, feeling overwhelmed, feeling like they're not being heard or listened to, what would some advice be for them if they weren't feeling their best self, whether that's physically or emotionally, and how would you reach out to them if they're listening?
One of the really important things is, I think, especially in starting the kidney care journey, is there are going to be ups and downs. And so sometimes it's important to sit with those feelings that aren't so good. And, we have to cope, we have to grieve the loss of a life that we once lived, where we were free of this attachment to the medical care system, to dialysis, to immunosuppressants. And so it is a dramatic change in our life. And I think part of that is grieving the loss of the life that we once had and kind of reconciling this new sort of existence. And one of the biggest things that I had to come to terms with was that getting a transplant wasn't a cure per se. There's sort of a transition into a better way of life. But it still meant, like you said, like it was still an attachment to the care system. It was still medications daily. It was still appointments routinely. And so it's really the biggest thing for me was having a peer group who was going through it. So connecting with others who are going through it, it works magic. I don't know, I can't explain it.
It does.
But as soon as I connect with someone who's gone through it, like when I connected with you, I'm like lit up, I'm inspired. I'm like, all of a sudden everything feels a little bit more okay. Even if it's not fully okay, you're like, okay, yeah, this is going to be all right. I'm alive still. And for me, that was another thing, was really having purpose in my life kept me alive and kept me going. So for me, that was, you know, finishing my master's and then, you know, my doctorate. But for other people, it's going to be something different for everybody. But really having purpose in life makes a big difference.
That's really good advice. I had someone recently who, we were talking about, you know, the mental health journey that you go through when you're on this kidney journey. And he said, you know, some days I don't think I would have gotten out of bed if it wasn't for my dog. And he said, you know, my dog is my person and he wakes me up every day. And he's like, sorry, buddy, I don't care how you feel. I have to go pee. Like, you have to let me out. You have to feed me. And you know what? And he said he will sit at the bottom of the bed and stare at me and sometimes whine if I don't take him for a walk.
Right.
And he said, you know, he is my driving force and I want to walk with him and I want to walk further with him. So, you know, I think about transplant and how can I keep myself healthy so that I can be transplanted, so eventually we can go further, we can run together, we can hike together. And you know, you talk about that purpose, and whether it's something huge like you know, getting your doctorate or traveling or you know, doing those things, or maybe it's something more day to day, like being able to have a shower without being exhausted after you have a shower, or walking your dog and not feeling exhausted the whole way. Like, I think, like you said, having that purpose, making those goals and really striving to do it. And I'm amazed by you. I think I've told you that before, but you know, all of this work is so incredibly important, and to have somebody who has been through this and is going through this to then reach out and support the community is incredible. And you know, before we leave today, I want to ask you, do you have anything else you would like our listeners to hear about? We're going to link a lot of what you talked about today in the notes as well, so people can check out more too.
Yeah, I think primarily if anyone's interested in joining the Indigenous Kidney Health Project, if there are any First Nations patients or healthcare providers who are interested in supporting, we'd be happy to have you join our team. And so and share my email. And I think really just, talking to one another is the most important thing. Connecting with a network of people who have been through it is so important. So if you can find that, I think that's a life-saving avenue to improving well-being.
Absolutely. And if you feel like you don't have one of those, you've got two people who have just been chatting now who would be very much willing to be part of your network. So please reach out. Yes. Amazing. Thank you so much, Crystal. I always feel so happy when I get to chat with you. We just met each other and I already feel like we've been friends forever. So thank you so much for taking the time today and for all of your incredible work. And if anyone is interested, you can take a look at the show notes and connect with Crystal for sure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Candace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.